You are about to witness history in the making. Despite the world's highest living standards, the average American remained vaguely discontent, aware that his goal of a better way of life had still not been fully realized. There was something missing.
There's this awful gap in our lives just because we don't have... Oh, but why talk about it?
It's just that... Oh, I keep hoping someone can find a way to...
Don't be a fool, Mary. You know that's impossible.
Oh, I know. It's just that...
Gad, it's ironic. With all our technology and industrial know-how, we still don't have the one thing that could give us a better way of life.
It's the Forgotten Filmcast.
You see, this is a real home, belonging to the entire family, where every member has a pride of ownership.
Welcome to episode 189 of the Forgotten Filmcast. My name is Todd Liebenow, and thanks for joining me for this look at the movies that time forgot. On this episode, I'll be joined by Chris Sterren from the Popcorn Auteur to discuss a 1972 film with a Doberman at the center of a murder plot, starring James Garner, Catherine Ross, and Hal Holbrook, directed by James Goldstone. It's They Only Kill Their Masters. But first...
See the difference? Marie concentrated on her brother instead of on...
The Forgotten Film Cast.
And the result was a better personality.
Names of merchants who give dividend tickets are listed in the lobby of the theater and on circulars at the concession stand. Dividend tickets will be accepted on all standard box office priced films. So take a circular with you today and start saving dividend tickets tomorrow when you shop. See your next movie completely free.
Drive away your worries and cares at this drive-in theater, where you will see the finest motion pictures of all time soon to be released. Drama, comedy, adventure, excitement, something for everyone. Here's a brief glimpse of some of the truly fine pictures we've scheduled in the near future.
I'm not going back there.
Look, Beth, the only way we can get this thing over with is to burn the body.
Now, for those who have seen The Exorcist, Carrie, and Ruby, here is new unspeakable horror in Nurse Sherry. From a doomed medical operation to the return of an evil human soul, driven to evil in a strange and gruesome story from the other side of life.
You know absolutely nothing about what you're dealing with.
Don't be afraid. Take my hand and come with me.
with me, Sherry, and I'll introduce you to the bliss that lies beyond the borders of hell.
Living, breathing terror chills your flowing blood and shocks your nervous system. Cold in Nurse Sherry. It's the year's most frightening journey into the hidden world of the supernatural. And it soon becomes a nightmare of living hell and torment.
Gotcha.
If we were in the 17th century, I'd be inclined to diagnose her symptoms as a classical case of possession.
Don't touch me!
Stay where you are. Don't interfere with things you know nothing about.
Your powers are finite. Mine are limitless.
Meet Nurse Sherry and travel into the hidden corridors of a twisted mind to the very core of her tormented soul. It's more bizarre, more terrifying than your most frightening fears. Nurse Sherry. Don't miss Nurse Sherry for an evening of pleasure and terror. Nurse Sherry in color, rated R for adults. Under 17, not admitted without parent. From Independent International.
The Art of the Samurai. Not fast enough.
He could be just another war casualty.
You asking me to kill one of my own kind?
The only brother's the man of a dollar bill. And he ain't black.
Douglas Russell, a cold, calculating death machine. A one-man death force.
That kid needs a father.
He don't need a mother like you for a father.
You got sent out here to pick up a Japanese straggler. Do I look like a Japanese straggler?
Morelli got a guy named McGee with him.
Oh, like a Siamese twin.
I think I'll look him up.
Where's Morelli? And McGee? I ask you a question.
Whoever it is, I want him.
Let the guy go. You'll probably never hear from him again.
Look, Brooks, you better make sure I never hear from him again. You got it? What the hell did he ever know about swords?
Hey, I'll take it down to the morgue, and I'll show you what he knows about swords.
Out of doorways, black umbrellas came to pursue me.
Let it go.
$100,000, Russell.
I didn't know I was worth so much.
What are you talking about, quitting?
Because I want to hang on to my head.
Force. When would he stop? And who could stop him?
And now, on with the show.
You're supposed to use the phone.
Yes, ma'am. I am Abel Marsh, Chief of Police. I've got a court order here from the Campbell Inquest to put away the Doberman Pinscher.
Nobody calls them Doberman Pinschers anymore. Just Doberman or Dobe.
Neat.
I suppose you want to see the dog.
But not particularly, miss.
Mrs. Bingham. Come on, Mr. Marsh. Don't be nervous. They only kill their masters.
He's a beautiful dog. It's a shame.
Why would a dog do that?
There was a similar incident a couple of years ago, somewhere. Also a woman. She'd been beating the dog for years. It turned. Got her by the throat. Well, you know that if you saw Mrs. Campbell.
By the throat?
That's what they go for, you know.
No, I don't know. I don't know very much about dogs. Don't like them, really, particularly Dobermans. I don't know why people have them.
Well, anyway, he's very well trained. Tell him to do something. Tell him to sit.
What's his name?
Murphy.
Sit, Murphy. Hey, Murphy. Come here. Sit down, Murphy. Oh, hi, Warren. How you been?
Abel, you left him on a command.
What?
He'll just sit.
Release him, Abel.
How?
Okay. We'll put him to sleep for $20. You tell us when, Mr. Marsh.
Where'd you get her?
What?
What do you use to put the dog away?
Pentobarbital, sodium pentobarbital. It's like Nembutal for euthanasia. 5 grams with CC and 1 cc for every 5 pounds. They just go to sleep. For a big dog like a shepherd or a dobe, it takes about a half an hour.
You got quite a job.
Better than yours. Don't worry, we'll get to it after work tonight, okay?
Yeah.
I'll see you.
By the throat, huh? And what'd you chew on her hands and feet for, huh? Why'd you do that?
Okay, our movie this time is They Only Killed Their Masters from 1972. And joining me to discuss this film is Chris Sterren from The Popcorn Auteur. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Glad to be back. Thanks for having me.
Always great to have you back. Why don't you take a moment, tell everybody a little bit about yourself and what you do?
Yeah, so I host a podcast called The Popcorn Auteur. It sounds way fancier than it should because it's really just a buddy and me who aren't always the best educated about films trying to fill our education. We call it our film education because we roughly every month we pick a filmmaker and look at all the films that they have both written and directed, and then we talk about them. So we just did kind of an off the beaten path one. We did Justin Benson and Aaron Moorhead, and we've got Sarah Polley probably coming up about the same time this one drops. So yeah, we're always learning something new as we expose ourselves to different filmmakers.
Well, I love that philosophy because expanding your film knowledge, your film education, the way to do that is, of course, watching more movies. You know, I mean, you can read lots of books on the subject and read reviews and check out what people think about things. But ultimately, the best way to increase your film education is just to sit down and watch movies. And I got that. That's a lot more fun than, you know, what I remember from like going to high school and stuff. So I can get behind that.
Yeah, it's an all right education, and we get to go at our own pace, so it works out.
I actually remember one of my college courses, it thrilled me when I signed up for this one writing course one time, and it turned out that the teacher was like, you know, I get tired of reading papers that are about a million different subjects, so in this class, we write all our papers about movies, and I was like, yes, I didn't even know that when I signed up for the class.
You hit the jackpot.
I did indeed. Yes, I became the star pupil in that class. So, I mean, as you're trying to become a star pupil here, as you go through your film education, you've covered a lot of different directors. How do you determine which ones you're going to cover?
I mean, I think we tend a little bit towards more modern. I think the original premise was, we were always big Star Wars fans, you know, kind of thought like the Star Wars movies and the Spielberg stuff of the 80s was, you know, the height of what we had termed popcorn auteurs. And we're trying to figure out who are the new people making those types of movies? So we're looking for like somebody that's got kind of a distinct voice, but kind of a little bit more blockbustery. We've kind of gotten a little bit away from that, but now we just try to find interesting voices that are making films that maybe sometimes are getting a lot of attention and sometimes are just somebody who's like we did Casey Lemons a couple months ago, who had like a 15-year gap in her filmography, and was like wondering, who's this filmmaker that didn't make a movie for a really long time. There's always somebody interesting to discover, and it's been fun to find the ones that they've only made three films over their career, but maybe we're missing something by not talking about them more. So,
well, I mean, that was as good a segue as any. You talked about discovering people. Are there any that you've discovered because you did an episode on them and you were just like, wow, I just hadn't really been very aware of this director at all. And now that I've seen several of their films, I'm just like, wow, I want to see everything that they do.
Yeah. I mean, I said we skew more modern, but we did a Elaine May episode.
Oh, wonderful.
Elaine May is somebody who is probably most known for the failure of Ishtar. And, when you actually look at her other films, she's just a fascinating filmmaker from the start to finish, where she did like the broad comedy like Ishtar, but she also did Mikey and Nikki, which is this really dark film that's in the Criterion Collection now. So when you look at somebody like that and you're like, oh, I only thought she was like I knew her from Ishtar and that was it. And so it was fun to check her out more recently. Yeah, it's also like we did David Cronenberg not that long ago, and like a name that you know, but like when you actually like go back and look at all his films, it's like, oh wow, there's a lot here that I didn't know that he did, and you find oddities that are sometimes really, really interesting. So, those are two kind of more recent names where you're like, where I've been impressed by them.
Jumping back to Elaine May, I've had similar discovery process with her recently because I watched Ishtar back when it came out in the 80s. That's when I was pretty much devouring everything at the video store. And Ishtar, I remember my parents brought it home one night and I was like, this thing's supposed to be awful. And I was like, oh, that's not so bad. That's funny, but it wasn't until just the last few years that I've seen some other stuff. I think the first one I watched was A New Leaf.
Yeah, it's fantastic.
It's wonderful. It was.
Oh my gosh, it's so good.
It was on the Criterion Channel, and so I watched that, and it became one of my favorite discoveries of the year. I thought Walter Matthau was fantastic. Elaine May, of course, is in it as well, and she was probably my favorite actress of the year, and her direction of the film is just so skillful, and she wrote it. It's just the full package, just a wonderful movie. And then, a short time later, I watched Mikey and Nikki with no knowledge about what this thing was. I was like, oh, okay, Peter Falk. Peter Falk's a funny guy. It's probably another funny movie. And it's not at all. I was not expecting that. But still, a great movie.
Yeah.
I haven't, of course, seen The Heartbreak Kid yet because it's so difficult to locate these days. I think there may be the stray copy out there on YouTube or something like that. But I don't know that it has a legitimate release right now.
Yeah, she was one that definitely it was a really good education. A New Leaf was just so good. And my wife, when we were watching it, my wife goes, this is like one of those, they always call movies, oh, it's a dark comedy. She goes, I find when I see those dark comedies, a lot of times they're not funny. This is actually, this is a dark comedy that's just absolutely hilarious. Like, you like actually take a step back and like what Walter Matthau is doing and saying, it's like, wow, this is dark. But it is just hilarious. Yeah,
it's one of those roles that's just tailor-made for Walter Matthau, too. His delivery was perfect. All right, well, before we get onto this movie, I want to ask you one more question. Is there any director that you are just like, we got to do him on the show, but you just haven't gotten to him yet, that you're just like, oh, I can't believe we've missed this one for so long.
I mean, there's a few. I think the biggest one is, I mean, I think we have to do Stanley Kubrick before we decide to close up the podcast. There's like some directors where it's just like you're as novice and people getting educated. When you look at a name like Kubrick, you're like, well, if we do this, what are we actually, what new could we possibly say or do? But it's like, I also just want to do it. I also just want to kind of go through the whole filmography and just kind of delve into it. So yeah, that's one name that that's always been on my to-do list that just, we'll eventually cross off. Maybe it'll be our final episode, but, or episodes, cause it'll probably be a multi-parter.
Well, that is definitely one to hit on for sure. Yeah. I was talking with someone else a few weeks ago, and just with Kubrick, I was talking about how I think I've seen just about everything, but I keep on skipping over Barry Lyndon. I have not seen Barry Lyndon yet, and I need to remedy that. But every time I sit down to watch it, I'm like, oh, it's 3 hours long.
Yeah. I have not seen that one either. I think I did have that back in the day, a Netflix DVD that was sitting on my entertainment center for a while, and I was like, I don't know, I'm just not going to get to this. Just not ready for it.
Too many movies, so little time. Which
is another reason why I like the podcast, because it like makes me like say like, nope, no more putting off these classics from these filmmakers. Gotta watch them. Time to do it.
Absolutely. Yeah. Well, let's get on with this movie we have here today. It's from a director that I don't think will ever appear on the list because he's not exactly a household name, but that's the way things work on the Forgotten Filmcast. So this is They Only Killed Our Masters from 1972. It's directed by James Goldstone, who is a director mainly known for his work in television. He directed lots of episodes of lots of classic shows. Just a few of the ones that jumped out at me. He did episodes of Star Trek, Rawhide, Perry Mason, The Man from U.N.C.L.E., The Fugitive, The Outer Limits. So just about every major TV show of the 60s. This guy worked on at some point. He also had his share of feature films. Other than this one, he did some things like The Gang That Couldn't Shoot Straight, Swashbuckler, and then, of course, the 1977 disaster film Roller Coaster. Now, this film, it focuses on a guy named Abel Marsh, played by James Gardner. He is the police chief of a small California coastal town called Eden Landing. It's a very small town with quirky local folks and a police force that only has two patrol cars and, you know, just small little place. And as the movie opens, he is returning from vacationing in Los Angeles. And right as he comes back, he learns that the body of a woman named Jenny Campbell has been discovered on the beach, her pet Doberman standing over it. And there are wounds on the body, which seem to point towards the dog having killed the woman. Now, Abel starts to look into the case, first visiting the local veterinarian who was called to assist with the dog when the cops found the body. The vet is Dr. Warren Watkins, played by Hal Holbrook. And while Abel is at the vet's office, he meets the lovely new nurse of this veterinarian, Kate, who's played by Catherine Ross. Of course, some romantic sparks begin to fly between Abel and Kate. Now, rather than see the dog put to sleep, Abel decides to take in the pooch, whose name is Murphy. And even though he's not really fond of dogs, so now he goes about investigating the case further. He interviews the ex-husband of the dead woman, Mr. Campbell, played by Peter Lawford. He's kind of a rich playboy type who hangs out with women much younger than him. And he reveals that his ex-wife left him a year or so earlier for another woman. Now, the case gets even more complicated when Campbell ends up dead himself, and the home that he once shared with his ex-wife is torched. Meanwhile, Abel continues to look to the dog Murphy for the answers as to who is responsible for these small town murders. Now, the film is written by a guy named Lane Slate, and I feel like we should mention this because he would go on to write several projects after this that would reuse things from this film. About a year after this, he wrote a TV movie that's called Isn't It Shocking, which also featured a small town police chief. That movie starred Alan Alda. Then about another year later in 74, he would write a TV movie called Winter Kill, which starred Andy Griffith. And it had a similar premise with a small town police chief. And then about a year after that, in 75, there was a short-lived TV show called Adams of Eagle Lake, which also had a similar premise. And then Lane would even use the same character name from this movie, Abel Marsh, for two more TV movies, again starring Andy Griffith. They were The Girl in the Empty Grave and Deadly Game. So clearly the writer of this really wanted this concept to turn into something, but it didn't quite happen. But jumping back to the movie itself, I'm going to let Chris start us out here. Give us a few of your thoughts on They Only Kill Their Masters.
Yeah, it's fascinating that he kept on getting paid to make the same script over and over again. So I guess just initially, like, why, you know, you kind of gave me a list of some films to choose from and why this one jumped out at me. I was thinking the whodunit is having a slight moment right now with the Knives Out movies and Kenneth Branagh's Agatha Christie movies. So I was like, okay, let's look at one from the past. And, you know, I saw the movie poster with James Garner and the dog, and I'm like, this could be something. It could be interesting. We'll get into whether it was. So first off, I'm all for shorter movies, and at 97 minutes, this definitely fits the bill and shorter. But to me, and I'm curious what you thought, it felt a little hollow to me. It felt a little rushed at times, especially the romance between Garner and Catherine Ross just seemed super underdeveloped. You mentioned in your synopsis that sparks flew. I don't remember seeing the sparks, except that I knew they ended up in bed together.
Yes. Quick sparks. Yes.
Yeah. Looking at some like the reviews of the time, Roger Ebert noted that the film contains, quote, the longest, clumsiest, and most hapless seduction in the kitchen scene I have ever seen, which I thought was appropriate. Meatloaf. Meatloaf is not always the sexy meal that you're gonna get, but it works if you look like James Garner, I guess. The mystery is, I think the premise is interesting here. I like the premise and the setting. I think that's probably what this film does best. The small town police chief, where the sheriffs are the big deal, and you know, the got the little bit of a chip on the shoulder, and this interesting seaside California setting with these interesting characters in the police force, and then all these other characters that we run into as he's trying to solve this case. I don't know. For me, the execution wasn't great. If I see a poster with James Garner and a dog on it, I want James Garner and a dog. And I felt like we needed more Murphy. We needed more dog in this film. James Garner, he's really left alone here to kind of carry this film, but he's playing it so straight here that there's not a lot that interesting in his character. And for me, the bumbling police department was never quite bumbling enough. It never got to like laugh out loud funny. It was all played like a little too straight, like the car seat, the word processor and typewriter, like it was all very, very straightforward in the way that it was all handled. It felt like actual, too real of conversations. The comedy didn't work for me. And then the one thing that I think really it took me out of it a little bit was the score in this film by Perry Botkins Jr. Left a lot to be desired for me. I don't know if it's just a product of the time, but it seemed... You mentioned that the writer would go on to write a bunch of movies of the week type thing, TV movies, and the score has that kind of quality. It never really heightens the experience to either play up any of the stuff that's kind of supposed to be funny, or when things get serious, just all kind of feels very generic, kind of meandering score. So Yeah, so it wasn't didn't strike me as like a great one, but again, at 97 minutes, it's you know, you could do worse, but not a whodunit. I feel like people need to immediately go to seek out as a hidden gem.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the whodunit aspect goes, it was a very simple kind of mystery. It doesn't get too terribly deep. And in a lot of ways, I'm okay with that because I have said it on this show and other shows many times. I am not wired for mysteries. And yeah. I think part of the problem is I compare myself to my wife. My wife, she is a big time reader, and a lot of what she reads is mysteries. And a lot of times we sit down with a mystery movie, she's got it figured out halfway through. And it's just because she is always exposing herself to that type of thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And I just am not wired that way. My brain moves too slow. I don't know what it is, but you know, I can't figure these things out. So to have a mystery that's a bit more simple, I was okay with that. I didn't think it was anything revolutionary. It kept me interested. It didn't challenge me, but I was okay with that. I think you're absolutely right in that the kind of the atmosphere of this and the setup is one of the things that works the best about it. I did really enjoy that small town, weird kind of small town type of setting to it. I mean, it's almost like, I don't know, this strange California coastal version of Mayberry or something like that. Just James Garner is this one guy, this kind of straight arrow in this otherwise somewhat off-kilter town where, you know, there's all these other characters that are just a little bit weird, and they come and go in the story. And in some ways, he seems like the only sane person in the whole thing, which does in some ways make him kind of like what you're saying, a somewhat flat character. In the hands of James Garner, I still think he makes the character somewhat interesting, but he's surrounded by a lot of colorful folks, but his character himself is not really all that interesting.
No. Yeah. He's not. He's not a colorful character. Yeah. He's playing off all the oddities of the people that he's working with in like the police department and the sheriffs. But like, yeah, one of the most aggressive things we see him do is when he gets upset with the sheriff's car in the way and just kind of backs into it and kind of shows a little aggressiveness there. But yeah, most of the time he's just kind of slowly kind of working his way through the case and not rushing. There's this scene early in the film where he first is, I think, investigating in the house, and he's like, the killer is, you know, looking for something too, and is running out of the house. And he's like, he's not really making much of a pursuit, or, you know,
yeah.
Not really calling this one in and be like, okay, the killer was just here. We need to get a search party out. He's like, well, I guess I missed my chance there. Well, it'll come back around. Nothing too big to worry about.
Well, and I've wondered if part of that is just, I don't know if he just doesn't have that much faith in his fellow police officers, because they're all a little bit off, you know. And I did like just kind of the character quirks about them. I mean, like I say, watching them, I don't know how effective they are in their jobs, but there were a lot of just, like we say, quirky aspects to them that I found interesting. Like, the thing that I really liked that kind of summed up what a small town this is was the idea that they've only got two cop cars, and that the various members of the police force basically take turns using the police cars to run their own personal errands.
Yeah.
Like, the one guy's got to take his wife to the orthodontist and all that kind of stuff. And it's like, who's got the car right now? And all that. I thought that was really, really a nice touch.
Yeah, when he has to take the taxi at one point.
Yeah.
The cars are all in use for other errands. Yeah.
I mean, with that too, just the whole, I don't know, the dynamic of the town itself, I thought was interesting. I mean, in some ways, there's almost a thematic element of this movie kind of around class, you know, like the haves and the have-nots, so to speak, because it's a small town with small town folk, and we see different people that, you know, are the the worker bees of the community, the cops, the guy that runs the diner, the guy that runs the liquor store, things like that. And they're all these kind of quirky characters. And then the mystery itself, though, kind of centers around the people that would be the more wealthy element of this community. You know, you've got this woman who was found dead, and she was the wife of this guy who, you know, he's got a fancy car and he's dining in the fancy restaurant and all that. He's just, you know, he looks like, I don't know. I don't remember if they actually said what he does for a living in the film, but, you know, clearly he's a guy that's got money. I got the impression that, you know, maybe this place they have in this small town is like their weekend home, their vacation home. And they work in LA, live in LA, and then they come up there for the summer or something like that. And then even the element of the veterinarian, who plays more into the mystery, which we'll reveal when we get further down the line here. You know, again, you got to figure the veterinarian, the local town vet, is going to be one of the wealthier people in the town, you know. So you basically, the people that are setting the crimes, the murder, the mystery in motion are the haves, and it's the have-nots who are trying to figure it all out.
Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I didn't really think about it too much as I was watching it, but yeah, it's I think it goes to the strength of the setting, which is, again, I think one of the better parts of it, because you, like you said, you're taking Mayberry and putting it on like the California coast. So then you you introduce all this some interesting class dynamics too there, where you've got like the small town folk, but they're butting up against the California wealth, and also like the California, what I'm assuming kind of at the time was like supposed to be like the, how do I want to say, the sexual renaissance, or, you know, more like depending on how you might have viewed it from a Mayberry perspective, the depravity, because, oh my gosh, you've got lesbians and you've got you know, you've got threesomes and, you know, what, pictures of people, naked people and people having sex. So it's like that. You throw in like the, you know, look at all this crazy stuff that's going on in California type premise in there too, that always can titillate. So yeah, it's that. I think as much as the execution isn't always great, the premise and the setting are what work. Maybe that's why the writer kept on going back to it, because he wanted to kept on like, this should work. I should be able to do this.
Well, and I mean, speaking of all those other versions or, you know, kind of things that had similar premises, you know, those were all TV projects. And aside from that more titillating aspect of the story, if we want to call it that aside, for the most part, this film really felt to me more like a pilot for a TV series.
Yeah.
And I'm not saying that, you know, as a negative necessarily, but just a lot of things when it comes to the setup, kind of the setup of the community, this small town environment. You know, you've got this one central figure, James Garner, who is weaving his way through this mystery. And you've got all these other than side characters that are a little strange and quirky around him. You know, you get the idea that you're just getting little bits and pieces of this guy and that guy. And that, you know, if this was a series, we'd see them developed more down the road. And, you know, even as the, you know, the story starts to get resolved and we get to the end of things, you get the impression like, you know, it's very much just kind of putting this story to rest, but leaving it open for, you know, the future adventures of this small town sheriff. And, you know, it just very much had, you know, you know, the story stands alone, but it's very much feels like it's planting seeds of something that would have developed as a series. So there's a part of me that wonders, you know, just given the fact that this writer went on to do other TV pilots and, you know, short-lived TV series, if, you know, maybe this wasn't initially written as the first adventure of a sheriff that would be on your TVs every week.
Yeah, it definitely has the feel of something that could turn into like a case of the week type setting with the characters that you mentioned. Yeah, I definitely can see that feel to it.
Well, let's talk about our central character a bit more here, or I guess more specifically, the actor, James Garner, which when we settled on this one, I was just like, oh, here comes James Garner again, because I've said this to many people. I've said this on a couple of different podcasts in recent memory here, but I just keep on running into James Garner movies, sometimes on purpose. And sometimes I'm sitting down to watch something and I go, oh my goodness, James Garner is in this. And I continue to be very impressed with him as an actor. He's kind of one of those guys that I have, just realizing that he was much more than the Rockford Files, and I'm enjoying it immensely. But I guess, what's your take on what James Garner is bringing in this film?
I mean, as we kind of talked about a little bit, I think he's, if it wasn't James Garner or wasn't somebody that had at least some movie star magnetism, this would be a real slog to get through, because a lot of what he's given to work with in the script and is just not that great. He doesn't have any great zingers or great one-liners. He doesn't have any big set pieces that he's got to pull off. He's just kind of, like we said, he's just kind of meandering through the story as the straight man. And he really relies on his just kind of natural star power to pull it off. And I think he works in the role. I guess I don't fault him for anything that I find lacking in this movie. It's not his performance or, any choices that he's making that I think make the film less successful, but it's just, he's not always given a ton to work with.
Yeah. I get where you're coming from there. It's, there's nothing flashy about it for sure. And yeah, the script, it's pretty basic. There's nothing that, gives him, like you say, any kind of quick comebacks or thing like that. I mean, his iconic line in the whole thing is he says neat over and over again, but I do think that, like you said, Garner does fit well in this role. And yeah, I have to think watching this movie that it probably wouldn't have engaged me as much as it did if it hadn't been James Garner. I think that he does carry the movie in a lot of ways. And, like I say, I do enjoy seeing him in lots of things. And I think that he's perfectly fine in this. It's not, a stellar performance, but I think, kind of like you were saying there, just his natural charisma is part of what carries this through and makes the movie, entertaining on a certain level.
Yeah, I think so.
How about his leading lady here, Catherine Ross?
Well, I mean, if we think that Garner doesn't have a lot to work with, I feel like she's got even less. I mean, I find the romance aspect of this film, I think it fails largely.
It kind of comes out of left field. I mean,
right.
There's a part of me that was going, well, she's the female lead, so of course it's going to happen. But right. Yeah, there's not a ton of chemistry going on there.
Yeah, it seems like it does seem just like as a matter of course, like is the formula, like, okay, he's got to have a love interest, and then at some point she has to be a suspect. And so again, I don't fault her. I don't know. I don't think it's a great performance. I think she seems sometimes a little too calm with the whole concept of the murder and what's happening with the dog. And
yeah.
She's a little too cool of a customer to she's not the police person. So I feel like she should be a little more frazzled by some of the things going on around her. But I feel like she needed to bring a little bit more energy, a little bit more worry into the situation where she's just as cool and collected as James Garner is, which I think doesn't, we already have our straight person. So we need somebody to need either saving or be worried a little bit more.
I do think that lack of emotion, if you want to call it that, did make her a little bit more of a mysterious character. And I did appreciate that to a degree, because, you like James Garner's character does, you do start to wonder how much she is involved in all of this. And you're not totally sure what to make of her at every junction in this movie. So I did find that a bit intriguing, but I got the impression going throughout that she was actually more drawn to the dog than she was to James Garner.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah, you're right. The mysterious aspect, I think, was maybe what they were going for, because there's the whole her mysterious past and that she doesn't want to get into, and you know, why she's even in this small town and working this job. So, yeah. I think that makes sense, making her kind of the stoic, mysterious character. Yeah, I think I just wanted something to kind of play differently to Gardner's cool character, and maybe have her be a little different, bring a different energy to some of the scenes. But I think you're right. I think that's what they were intending to work, and why she's more of a stoic presence.
You talk about that kind of being the stoic presence and stuff. I did, though, one scene where that comes into play. I like the scene where this is after they've been in bed, and the dog jumps up on the bed, and we have moment where he's you know, looking like he's going to go for James Garner's throat, and you know, she has to gingerly get out of the bed and get the leash and all that. I actually found the tension in that scene to be very effective. You've seen many scenes in movies where you've got, you know, dogs snarling and growling at and barking at folks like that. But this one, I thought, was one of the tenser scenes like that I'd ever seen.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, back to one of my initial points is I wanted more Murphy. I mean, you talked about the mystery being pretty straightforward, but, I thought that was fine, that it was straightforward. One of the things that I didn't really love is, though, that they immediately, with the coroner, are like, nope, wasn't the dog. She drowned, and she didn't even drown in the ocean. But definitely wasn't the dog. You know, maybe, you know, don't make the dog more of a actual suspect in this case, and maybe then the dog's got more to do. Because when the dog went crazy, you're like, well, I already know the dog didn't kill it, but there's obviously something interesting going on with the dog here. There's more to this dog than we initially were told. But yeah, more dog.
Well, everybody else in the town seems to believe that the dog did it. You know,
yeah. they read it in the paper.
That leads me to one more thing I want to talk about before we get to kind of the reveal and where the mystery goes and all that. But, you know, we've said several times that this town is full of a bunch of colorful characters. And I want to mention several of them here, but I guess maybe I'll open it up first. You know, were there any of these kind of side characters, you know, in the town here that top your list here?
I think that the guy, the owner of the diner, probably was the most entertaining.
Arthur O'Connell plays Ernie, the guy that runs the diner. Yes.
Yeah, just because he's, you know, he's kind of doing his own thing and not really worried about the law too much. And, you know, he's not going to put on a front just because Abel's there. He's, you know, if there's a bottle of scotch to drink, he's going to drink it. And
I love that moment where he tosses the bottle to him and, you know, like, is way off throwing it to James Gardner, and it slides across the lunch counter and breaks.
And
Gardner's like, really, Ernie?
Yeah. I think he was probably my number one for the kind of one of the colorful characters in town, for sure.
I thought he was a lot of fun. I wanted to also throw out Edmund O'Brien, who plays the liquor store owner, George. He's one of those guys that just, no matter what Garner says, he's like, oh, the dog killed that woman, you know, and that's the thing with all these side characters. I mean, these are names that are from classic movies here showing up in this early 70s film. You know, you've got like Peter Lawford, for example, plays the ex-husband of the woman who died, and, you know, just comes across as this completely slimy type of guy. You know, he's driving around in this fancy car, he's got this 19-year-old girl in a tight shirt with him, and, you know, just seems like a real slime ball. And then you've got one of the cops is played by Tom Ewell, who was in The Seven-Year Itch with Marilyn Monroe. And Ann Rutherford plays Gloria, who's one of the folks that helps out in the police station. And not a classic film star, but I got to mention one of the cops who has one of the weirdest moments in the film, where he's like, you know, down on the floor and, you know, they're talking about the dog and all that. But Art Matrano, who I always remember played Captain Mauser in a couple of the Police Academy movies, because I grew up on those movies. So it was funny to see him in an early 70s film, still as a cop. And then, of course, June Allison shows up in this film playing the wife of Hal Holbrook's character, which we've glossed over Hal Holbrook. Hal Holbrook is always great. And he does a good job in this. But his wife is played by June Allison, which I suppose is as good a place as any to segue into the big spoilers of the movie. So I guess if you don't want to hear what actually happened here, I guess jump forward a few moments here. But when we get to the reveal of the killer. So as the mystery progresses here, you know, Gardner's investigating. He becomes suspicious of Kate, Catherine Ross's character, of course, because she seems to know some things about the dog that she shouldn't know. And he starts to suspect that she is the dead woman's killer / lesbian lover. And when he confronts her, he then realizes that the things that she knows that made him suspicious came from information that her employer, the veterinarian Hal Holbrook, had. And so Garner then goes to arrest Hal Holbrook. And at first, he seems like he's going to go pretty willingly, but then he stabs Garner with a needle that's filled with the stuffs that you use to put dogs to sleep and all that. And it's really built up where we think that Hal Holbrook is the killer. But then we realize that they're fooling us. And, you know, once Garner gets out of the hospital, he goes after the doctor. But in the end, we learn that he was just covering for his wife, played by June Allison, and that she is the killer / lesbian lover, which would have been pretty scandalous for audiences at this time, considering what type of squeaky clean image June Allison had. I guess what's your thoughts on, you know, where the mystery goes, the reveal, and then the change of direction there to where the actual killer, who that was?
Yeah, like you said, I don't think it's surprising, just because for most of the movie, you have no idea, like any idea about Hal Holbrook's wife or her.
Yeah, I think she only appears in pictures, you know, at that point. Yeah.
Right. So there's nothing to really like lead you as the viewer, like to solve the mystery that way. So, like it's a good twist and surprise, I think. And one that still feels like, you know, satisfying and not just like, hey, look at how wacky this twist is, and it doesn't feel like it flows naturally from the plot. So I think that I found it pretty satisfying, and I thought it worked fairly well. I mean, I liked it. That was one of the scenes I did like, when James Garner is trying to arrest Hal Holbrook, and the woman comes in with her pug with the prostate problems, I believe. And gets stabbed by the shot. I thought that was that whole scene, and then the car chase set piece that follows, I thought worked well. So for how like lukewarm I was on like kind of the middle section and the romance, I thought as they kind of finalized the mystery and, you know, we got to the reveal, I thought it worked fairly well.
Yeah, I mean, it wraps up pretty simply. And again, you know, like I said, I'm fine with a simple mystery. And I do think that sequence, like you said, with Hal Holbrook is interesting. It does feel a little off, I think intentionally so, as you're watching it, because you're going, he's given up too easily here. You know, why is he so cooperative with James Garner? But then I love that moment you're talking about, where the woman comes with her pug, and, you know, he's got to be checked out by the vet because it's some kind of emergency. And he's like, you know, chief, is it okay? Just let me do this and then I'll go with you. And he's like, fine. And I'm like, this is just another example of what I think is the most successful thing about the film. We've talked about several times is this small town setting with these odd characters in there, where, you know, it's just like, okay, yes, I realize you killed two people and you burned down a house and all that, but you know what, you can take care of the pug before I take you to jail.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
I guess before we take it to the break, you know, imagining all the things we've said about that the writer had had, you know, many other projects that had a similar premise. He used this character's name again for, you know, a couple of TV movies. And, you know, we've said the feel of this feels a little bit like a TV pilot. Had this become a long running series, do you think you would have been interested?
Yeah, I mean, perhaps it would have been interesting to see how the Sleepy Town has enough enough crime to warrant a new episode every week. Would have been like the crime capital per capita of the world. But yeah, I think hypothetically it might have worked better as that kind of show versus just a one and done standalone movie.
Yeah, I think I was intrigued enough that I would have been curious to see where that might have gone, especially if it was still James Garner playing the part. I think as it is, this movie, it stands on its own perfectly fine. It's nothing flashy. It's not something that mystery fans are going to go nuts over. It's not going to challenge your brain into, you know, trying to discover all the little ins and outs of the mystery. It's very basic, very simple. And I agree that it meanders at times. It's a little dry at times. I think the things that charmed me about it the most were that small town setting, the quirky characters, and just the charm of James Garner. I think that James Garner has done plenty of other things that are more worthy, but this is, it's still pleasant enough, I guess, is the way I would put it. All right. Well, let's take a quick break here. We'll hear from another Lamb Podcasting Network show, and then we'll be back with our movie recommendations here on the Forgotten Filmcast.
You'll save money and time. You'll get the best of merchandise and service when you patronize these good neighbors. Shop with them regularly for friendly service and money-saving values.
At Cinema Recall, we want to present to you the finest in film analysis.
Yeah, like action and gore and sex.
We will look at classics by Kubrick, Lynch, Godard, De Palma, and Coppola.
I don't know who the f*** that is, but I'm looking at classic bodies of Christina Hendricks, Keanu Reeves, Salma Hayek, Ryan Reynolds.
We are a serious show for film lovers who enjoy indie foreign films, art house gems, and classic black and white features.
Well, I enjoy big budget blockbusters with great action and sexy people. Maybe our podcast can celebrate all aspects of films, like people who feel like your weird way and like people who feel like my weird way can like get together, man.
They can?
Yeah.
Huh. You know, I like that.
Cinema Recall is available everywhere you find great podcasts. Follow them on Facebook and Instagram under Cinema Recall Podcast and on Twitter at Cinema_Recall.
Hi, everybody. This is Todd. Just a quick reminder that you can now help support the Forgotten Filmcast through Patreon. For just a few little old dollars a month, you can support this show and earn access to some great bonus features, including a bunch of the older episodes of this show, which are no longer available on the main podcast feed. Visit patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast to learn more.
Good evening, folks, and a hearty welcome to our drive-in theater. We have a wonderful evening's entertainment lined up for you, one that will provide several hours of pleasurable relaxation and diversion for you and your family. Did you fail to dress up for tonight's show? No tie, an old shirt and slacks, a house dress? Well, don't give it a thought. We're glad you came as you are. We just want you to enjoy yourselves. Don't forget to visit our refreshment center during the intermission or any time. You love the tasty array of snacks we have to offer. So will the youngsters. Everything is quality and so good. We hope you'll make this a weekly visit. Bring the family. Bring your friends. There are always wonderful new pictures to see, delightful snacks to nibble, a gay, pleasant evening for all. Oh, a word of caution. Don't drive over 10 miles an hour in the theater area for your safety's sake. And Mom or Pop, go with the kids when they leave the car. We hope you have a wonderful time. Come back soon.
Okay, welcome back. It's time for our movie recommendations. This is the part of the show where each of us gets to talk about another movie, something we've really enjoyed that we want to tell others about. It might be a forgotten film. It could be an old classic. It could be something new in theaters or on streaming. It can be absolutely anything. So, Chris, what is your recommendation?
So every time I've been on, I like to try to find some link to the movie that we saw. And watching They Only Kill Their Masters made me think about better movies, some movies that had a setting in California and were whodunits. I thought that scene we talked about before break with the getting the shot when he's holding the pug, I was thinking, what if that was the dude from The Big Lebowski? Yeah, man, to take care of the dog, sure. Oh, man, what's that? You got me. So there's scenes in there that made me think, like, this is like a precursor to The Big Lebowski. But the movie that I'm going to recommend is Shane Black's The Nice Guys. I believe it is streaming on Netflix, as you mentioned, things that are streaming. So kind of didn't do great business when it came out, but Ryan Gosling and Russell Crowe in this one are just fantastic as this whodunit comedy with lots and lots of twists and turns. It gets a little confusing at times, maybe a little too much, but this setting of 1970s L.A., is important in this film, and I think really well done. Strong characters, it's comedic. It's one of like the most rewatchable movies for me. I just absolutely adore this film and highly recommend it. Shane Black's The Nice Guys.
That is a great pick. It is one that I need to revisit. I remember when I watched this back in 2016, it was one of my favorite movies of that year. Yeah. And it was one that after I was done, remember I said my wife is much more of a mystery fan, reads a lot of mysteries and such. And I said, you've got to watch this movie. You would really enjoy this. And you're absolutely right. This is another great example of kind of an interesting setting and time being kind of what propels the movie into being so darn entertaining. And I need to see this one again here. It's been too long. So yeah. Thank you for reminding me of that one.
And since it's a Shane Black movie, you can always watch it around Christmas time.
Exactly. Yes.
He always works Christmas in somehow.
Well, the movie that I'm going to recommend is one that also takes place in a small town. And it also features James Garner. Like I said, I've just been running into lots of James Garner movies recently. And this is one that I remember from back in the 80s. I never saw it back in the day. Finally saw it a year or so ago and just loved it. And that is 1985's Murphy's Romance, which stars Sally Field as this recently divorced single mom. She's a horse trainer. She comes to this small town in Arizona to start a new life with her son, who's played by Corey Haim before... all the other Corey Haim things, okay. Corey Feldman team ups, you know, all that. This is before that. But anyway, so they come to this small town and she is befriended by the local pharmacist played by James Garner. And when I say pharmacist, this is, you know, like he runs the local drugstore. And, you know, when you're the pharmacist there, not only are you mixing up the medicine for folks, but you also are like making milkshakes at the lunch counter and things like that, you know, that type of, you know, old school pharmacy type of thing. And so they strike up a friendship, and then her ex-husband comes back to town and is trying to make the moves. And so Garner's kind of, you know, trying to stop a bad thing from happening again. But at the same time, a bit of a romance is starting between him and Sally Field's character. And of course, he's much older than her. There's very much an age difference there. And that's a kind of an element of the story as well, where like all the local elderly ladies who would like to get their hands on Garner are all like giving him the side eye because of Sally Field and all that. But it's just a really charming romantic comedy. I mean, Garner is great. He got an Oscar nomination for this film, and I think it's well-deserved. Sally Field also just wonderfulness. I mean, basically showing that America's sweetheart type of thing that Sally Field was back in the mid-80s. And, you know, just got a funny, clever script. It's directed by Martin Ritt. And is one that when I watched it, I was like, dang, I should have watched that many, many years earlier. So, yeah, Murphy's Romance is a very, very good, I would say probably one of the best of the 80s rom-coms.
I'm going to put it on my to-watch list. That sounds great.
Excellent. Well, Chris, I want to thank you for being on the show. Before I let you go here, please remind everybody of where they can find you and your podcast.
Yeah, the podcast is The Popcorn Auteur. You can find it wherever you find podcasts. We are on Twitter at Popcorn Auteur. If you want to tweet at us, we don't really do much outward tweeting, but you know, social media is not my thing. But yeah, that's where you can find me.
Excellent. Thanks for being on the show, and I will be back to close things here in just a moment here on the Forgotten Filmcast. Well, folks, that's gonna do it for this episode of the show. Thank you so much for listening. As always, you can find other reviews of Forgotten Films over at the Forgotten Films blog. That's at forgottenfilmcast.wordpress.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Forgotten Films. That's films with a Z. And you can like Forgotten Films at Facebook. I welcome your questions, comments, and feedback about the show, so please email me at forgottenfilmcast@gmail.com. And don't forget to visit our Patreon page, patreon.com/forgottenfilmcast, where you can learn all about how you can help support this show. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, go watch some old movies. See you again soon.
The dog didn't eat that woman, huh? Well, listen, the paper said he did. It's right here.
This podcast is a proud member of the Lamb Podcasting Network. Find the network at largeassmovieblogs.com.